Hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. All right, so as per our usual agreement, I'll talk about what it is, I'll talk about how it's been, and then why it should matter to us. Try to answer those three questions. I'll talk for 45 minutes. We'll have a little break, and then 25 minutes for small group discussions, and then circle back for Q&A at the end. Here is the context where we are in RCIA. You've just done Honor Thy Father and Mother in Thou Shalt Not Kill and everything that entails. And tonight we have 6 to 9, which I believe I have done all 4 years of my year here. I don't know if they picked me on purpose, because before I was baptized, I probably committed most or many of them anyway. So I can speak slightly of personal experience. Just a recovering dirtbag. But anyway, so there's a lot of juicy stuff here tonight. Never short of conversation. The next time you'll round out the commandments with 7, 8, and 10, and then we have our interviews. So, what is it? You shalt not commit adultery. You find this in Exodus and Deuteronomy. And I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery in his heart. And then part of that is also the ninth commandment of thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. Any questions? All right, so we'll unpack that. There it is. What more do you want? So I think it's good as we, you know, most of the commandments, especially dealing with the horizontal, dealing with neighbors, are negative commandments in the sense, don't do this, right? Don't commit adultery. Somebody recently told me this joke I'd never heard of before. They said, so Moses, chosen people, they're all at Mount Sinai, and they're all in the valley. Moses goes up to the mountain, talks to God, comes back down. And then he goes back up the mountain a second time, we know. Then he comes back down again, and he says, I have good news and bad news. The good news is I got him down to 10. The bad news is he's not budging on adultery. I don't know why it's... But there is a joke. So in Catechism, here's where we're going to be floating around a lot tonight, in the 2300 section. So it starts with our vocation to love like God, right? For any of these commandments against adultery, against lust of the heart, it's saying, okay, there's something contrary to adultery, there's something contrary to lust with authentic love. And if we are to act the way God acts, if we are to be like God, like in the gospel, if you went to daily mass today or prayed with the daily mass readings, it says, be merciful as your Father is merciful. And so one of God's attributes, we might say, like, he is mercy. It's not just merciful. He doesn't just act merciful. He is mercy itself. Right? So God is love itself. He's not just loving, not just lovable, but he is love. So our vocation is to participate in the very life of God. And so it is to be like God, which is to love the way he loves. So this is how we would start this conversation. So there are some of those qualifiers, some attributes of what that love is. His love is forever. He doesn't get tired of us. Right? He doesn't quit. His love is faithful. It's not duplicitous. Right? That it is fruitful, and that is total. So when God loves us, he loves us in a forever way. He loves us in a faithful way, in a fruitful way, and a total way. So all human love, whether it's friendship, whether it's marriage, whether it's priesthood, is if it's real authentic love, it has to imitate its source. And so these are kind of 4 qualifiers that have come down to us of what that authentic love looks like. The very first commandment. Anyone want to take a guess? The very, very first commandment that God gave to humans. even before that, even before God said, like even before the Big Ten, there is a commandment found in Scripture. Be fruitful and multiply. That's the very first commandment that the Lord gives to humans. Right, so in addition, we're starting our conversation talking about we have to love the way God loves. So that's a positive thing, but it's also recognizing that our sexuality is good. Right? So often, whether it's in the Christian world or in the pagan world, but there can be this bugaboo that that our sexual desires are the sexuality of our bodies is somehow bad or dirty or wrong, and that we have to punish ourselves or whip ourselves or something in order for us to be pure. Well, nothing could be further from the truth that our sexuality is a gift that the Lord gives us. And that we were engendered and given our sexual desires from the very beginning. That this is good. This is not a trick. This isn't bad. This is given to us by design. This is part of God's original plan. So our sexuality is part of our identity. And certainly in our culture, we're a mess when it comes to understanding this and understanding this well. But it's definitely stamped into every single one of us. That the complementarity of the sexes highlights the equality of our nature, then also the diversity of the Creator's generosity and the power and fecundity and tenderness of what real love is. So in a sense, I'll teach Conference for the Engaged days. And so one of my talks, I'll begin by asking all the newly engaged there, you know, how many of you have a reproductive system? And maybe about half of the hands will go up. I said, well, you're all wrong, because you don't. None of us do. None of us have a reproductive system. We have reproductive organs that need the other parts to become a system. Right? So this, again, isn't cruel. This is made by design, that all of the other organs we have can make sense on themselves, except maybe the appendix or something. But I'm sure at some point in evolutionary history, we needed the appendix. Right? But all the other organs, you know, our digits, lungs, heart, like they all make sense kind of in themselves and creates the human system. But the only organ we have that doesn't make sense by itself is our sexual organ. It needs the other. Right? And so this draws out from the very beginning, even before sin, even before this tension, draws out the fact that humans are meant to be a gift for the other, that Adam is meant to be a gift for Eve, and Eve is meant to be a gift for Adam, that they're meant to get out of themselves, that Adam, in his original holiness, in his original creation, recognizes that it's not good for man to be alone. And so this is stamped into our very being, that we are made for communion. And then obviously we know that things went wrong, that original plan of the Lord was broken. But Jesus came to restore what was lost and to heal what was broken, including our sexuality. So the sixth and ninth commandment of don't commit adultery and don't covet your neighbor's wife essentially encompasses all of human sexuality. So that's what we have the great pleasure of talking about tonight. In Catechism 2337, it talks about the end goal in a word, chastity. And this is probably also one of the words that we need to like kind of stop and check ourselves, because we probably have a prejudice or we probably come with baggage or what we might think chastity is. And it's probably not exactly what the church would define chastity as, because we're all called to chastity. Obviously, I am. Married people are. Single people are. Every single human being is called to chastity. So by chastity, what we don't mean is abstinence, right? Meaning doing without something, in this case, sex. So chastity, as the church defines it, is a successful integration of sexuality within the person, and thus the inner unity of a man and a woman in their bodily and spiritual being. The successful integration of sexuality within the person. So they have this inner unity. A truly chaste person does not experience a tension between their sexual desires and what they know they should be doing. There's no tension there because it's integrated. There's no tension between seeing a beautiful person who's not their spouse. Because there's an integration between their sexuality, their being, what they know is the right thing to do, what they know they should be desiring, about how they view other people. Right? There's an integrity there and a wholeness there. So there's not these little boxes of like, okay, like I'll be loving to my wife when I go home, but when I'm at the gym, like I can stare all I want. So a truly chaste person doesn't have little boxes of, oh, I can act this way when I'm just with the guys, but when I'm with my kids, I'll act an entirely different way. But a truly chaste person is integrated in their sexual desires and in how they think, how they look, and how they talk. Catechism goes on in that section. Sexuality, in which man's belonging to the bodily and biological world is expressed, becomes personal and truly human when it is integrated into relationships of one person to another, and the complete and lifelong mutual gift of a man and a woman. The virtue of chastity, therefore, involves the integrity of the person and the integrality of the gift. So a chaste person isn't someone who flees from relationships, isn't someone who is afraid, you know, to have friendships with the opposite sex. It's someone who's completely integrated and kind of knows what they're about and knows what the other person is about in relationship to them. Right? So it's not saying, ooh, like, I recognize that this person is beautiful, so I need to run the other way. There's a famous story that comes from St. Pelagia. She was like in the 3rd or 4th century. But she was the town prostitute. And so she was walking down the street. I forget what town it was in. But there was kind of like a meeting of regional bishops. And she was walking, and two bishops were approaching her. And as the story recounts, this is told from the perspective of Pelagia many years later, that one of the bishops immediately casts his eyes away, and the other bishop stares intently at Pelagia, the town prostitute. The other bishop kind of notices that this is going on and pokes him in the ribs and says, "Brother, what are you doing? Avert your eyes." And then he doesn't, and so he kind of looks over, and he sees that bishop who is staring is crying and says something to the effect of, "Such beauty that is wasted, right? Pearls before swine." But this bishop locked eyes with Pelagia, and apparently this made an effect on her, and she goes to the bishop the next day and says, "Why did you look at me like that? Nobody's ever looked at me like that." He told her about Jesus, and she had a profound conversion. And she became a great saint, Saint Pelagia. And so she kind of rhetorically asked, which one of the two bishops gave the correct response? And the answer is both. Because they kind of both knew that one bishop knew he might be tempted to lust or to view her as an object or to judge her, right, if he stared. Where the other bishop kind of saw her inner beauty that she didn't recognize herself at that moment. So both had a chaste response in a certain sense, but obviously one had a more developed, more integral chastity, the one that could look at her with love and not look at her parts or look at her as an object or as a sinner. Catechism 2515 says that lust, the opposite of chastity, entails a movement of the sensitive appetites, so you know, our touch, our smell, our physical appetites, contrary to reason. So lust entails a movement of the sensitive appetites contrary to reason. St. John talks about kind of three main categories of lust: lust of the flesh. So this certainly falls within the sexual conversation, but it could be lust of the flesh in regards to gluttony, lust of the eyes. So this could be certainly looking at people in lust, right? But it could also be like comparing ourselves to one another for good or for ill, putting ourselves down or exalting ourselves falsely, or pride of life, right? Wanting to be like God, right? Wanting to be self-sufficient or all-powerful unto ourselves. So there are three kind of different types of lust that St. John defines in his first letter. But integrity means a balanced wholeness, a self-mastery over passions which lead to human freedom, not slavery. So it's often the devil. Archbishop Sheen gave a great talk on sin in general, where he kind of talks about how the devil and our blessed Lord have two different tactics kind of to prevent us from sinning, our Lord, you know, just reminds us, like, this isn't good. It's not going to work. This won't lead to your happiness. Don't do it. So it kind of sounds like a buzzkill, where the devil's like, oh, come on. Like, it's going to be great. It'll work this time. Like, everybody else is doing it. Aren't they happy? You know, so the devil's like our best friend right before the moment of sin. And then there's a switch, right, if we were to ever give in. That our blessed Lord's like, come here. Like, give me a hug. Like, it'll be all right. I'll forgive you. Right? And the devil's like, how dare you? Right? God will never forgive you. Like, you just took his mercy for granted. Like, you're the worst. This is a great little talk. He's obviously much more profound than me. Like, a 20-minute little talk, Archbishop Sheen on sin. Because what we think we're going to get when we're tempted is freedom. I do what I want. This looks good. I'm going to do it. But what we end up getting is slavery. And when we're striving for chastity, when we're striving for virtue and for holiness, it seems like a constraint, kind of like a list of no's. But when we really give into it, when we really strive for that, when we really do that hard work, what we experience is freedom. Right? So it's the exact opposite. This is one of my favorite quotes in all the catechism. Just it's beautifully blunt and profound. It follows 25:15. Either man governs his passions and finds peace, or he lets himself be dominated by them and becomes unhappy. There it is. Any questions? Either man governs his passions and finds peace, or lets himself be dominated by them and becomes unhappy. Right? So we act out of our will, what we desire, but we need to, this desire needs to lead to what is truly good, not just an apparent good. What is our intellect needs to be gravitating towards what is true, not just what appears true. And then our senses need to be surrounded by what is truly beautiful, not just blown away by kind of one impulse after the next. And when we do that, it's really our impulses, it's really our desires that are dominating us, rather than being in charge of our desires, right? And so the feelings, you might have heard it in another talk, right? They're morally neutral in the sense that something can simply arise and you get angry or you see, you know, a beautiful person and you can be like, wow, they're really beautiful or handsome. And then, okay, so you're just recognizing a feeling. You're just recognizing this passion is going on. You're not in the realm of virtue or vice yet. It's simply existing. Right? You see a big plate of bacon on Good Friday. You're like, oh boy. Right? So what do you do at that moment? So that's when virtue or vice kind of tips the scales of like, am I just going to give in because it looks great? Right? Well, then you're really not in charge of your own being. Right? It's really these animal appetites, these sensitive appetites, as the Catechism refers to it, that's controlling you. So you just recognize what's going on, and then you say, okay, what would be a virtuous response here? What should I do here? Not what do I want to do, but what's the best thing to do? Because that's ultimately what you should be wanting, but we're not all quite there yet. We have this tension. Catechism goes on. Chastity falls on the virtue of temperance, which seeks to guide all our passions. Right? So temperance is saying, okay, what's the best thing in this situation overall? Not just like, okay, this bacon appears to be good. It is good. Like the perfect balance of like protein and fat and salt. Okay, it's good. But is this good for me right now? Right? Is this the best good? Or should I be telling my appetites, like, no, I'm in charge. Today's Good Friday. I'm not giving in. There's a higher good, namely my self-denial, uniting myself to the sacrifice of Jesus. Right? Catechism 2342 talks about chastity as a lifelong and exacting work. One can never consider it acquired once and for all. So in that sense, it's like humility. Supremely important, supremely foundational, and if you think you've ever achieved it, you're wrong, right? You're lying to yourself. So one time early on in seminary, I had a real old priest mentor. I said, Father, at what point in my formation is this whole lust thing going to be taken care of? And he said, it's about 6 hours after you die. So buckle up, buttercup. Yeah, because that plate of bacon will always look good no matter what. Right? So like that, those sexual desires we have will always be with us, surprisingly, even in old people. Right? Don't think about it too much, but like it's a reality. But this is all, we all have to come to terms with the fact that this is also good. Like, we're made for bacon. We're given a sexual appetite for a reason. But we have to keep it in check. We have to order it for the flourishing of the entire person. So it's a lifelong exacting work. And it goes on, the next paragraph, it's a law of growth which progresses through stages marked by imperfection and too often by sin. So the church is very maternal in the sense that she doesn't expect our 100% complete integration now, even though it's something we might intellectually say, yes, I want that. Right? But she also recognizes, okay, like you're broken, and that brokenness will take time to heal. We can break a leg, and then we might want to run the next day, but we recognize that healing will take time. Okay, so we have to, rest, those bones have to realign, and then we can begin to walk again with some difficulty and pain, and then we, more and more pain, we push through the pain, and then maybe we can start to jog again. So that growth takes work, and it takes time, so we also have to be patient with ourselves. The Catechism talks about how it being essentially a group effort, that we can't just, like, pray it away in a certain sense, that it needs to involve a culture. Like a culture of good friends that are on the same page, a culture of what we consume, right? That certainly, one of my more kind of simple but profound experiences when I was doing the Camino Santiago in the winter by myself, I would go like days without seeing anybody else. And then I would go days without really being in a city. There'd be like little tiny, towns, like little mini markets, but it'd maybe be like one city with like stoplights and billboards and traffic and everything else, one city a week. So there's a lot of just nature and beauty in between. And I remember one of these times I was walking into a city, just kind of how revolting the advertisements were. And they weren't like explicit pornography, but in whatever they were selling, it was all just sexually suggestive. But it hit me like how kind of numb I'd become to all of it. And then just like how it struck me after so long of being in silence and in prayer and in beauty and just like, wow, like why? So it just noticed that, well, I had just been absorbed in this culture of kind of sensuality that I had ceased to really pay attention to it before. So kind of the culture, how we surround ourselves, sometimes we can't escape it, but we do have a lot of choice in the matter, what we listen to, what we read, the company we keep. It talks about self-mastery is ordered to the gift of self. Right? So in the sense that that famous phrase, we cannot give what we do not have, well, if we don't really possess ourselves, if we're not really in control of ourselves, it's really hard to be a good friend. It's hard to be a son. It's hard to be a father, right? It's hard to give of myself in these various relationships if I don't really have self-possession, right? And so it's really ordered not towards like this little project of self-help and I'm just going to do this trick or pray this novena and then like I'm going to be so great. It's really the order. I mean, hopefully we do make improvements, but it's not to be like, it's not this perfect little self-improvement project. That's not what holiness is. Holiness is a contact sport, right? And it's messy and it can be violent in the sense that it involves other people. It's the extraordinarily rare, like 0.001% of people that can become saints being a hermit. Right? That we need others, if nothing else, to hold up a mirror to us, to shine in a spotlight, or to just practice the virtues with, to grow in holiness with one another. Catechism 2346 talks about it blossoms in friendship. This is a wild line. Self-mastery is a promise of immortality. Right? That there's something in myself that will live forever. So it's this appreciation of the totality of myself that's immortal and that recognizing the immortality of the other person. That they are given a soul that will live forever and ever and ever and ever. So it's not transactional. It's not just, well, what can I get out of this person? So this person created in the image and likeness of God is going to live forever in heaven or hell, but either way, immortal. It leads to a spiritual communion that is ordered towards the other's good. Again, so it's not transactional. It's not what can I get out of them. It's how can I help them grow in holiness? 2360, sexuality is ordered towards conjugal love of a man and a woman. It is not something purely biological, but concerns the innermost being of the human person, in which a man and a woman commit themselves totally to one another until death. The twofold end of marriage is babies and bonding, essentially, to be fruitful in the unity of husband and wife. I had a priest mentor in long story short, but he did a lot of work on kind of rehabilitating prostitutes. And in some of that work, it was kind of just like healing, obviously, a lot of wounds and whatnot. But a lot of those wounds kind of started long before the street work. But they would say they would always have an imagination back to their high school crush. Fascinating insight. However many, people that would abuse them and they would allow themselves to be abused by varying degrees, there was always kind of like this hidden romantic part in them that they recognized that it wasn't just like this biological exchange, that really what they were imagining was actually more ordered towards like romance, even though obviously it was a complete bastardization of that. It's a fascinating insight. God made sex good and pleasurable, but not for its own sake, that it is even ordered for something beyond itself. 2362. That each and every marital act remains and is ordered per se to the procreation of human life. And for a just reason, children can be spaced within marriage. We'll get into the nitty gritty here in a minute. So it's part of the mission of marriage to generate and educate children. That's why marriage exists, first and foremost. By doing so, the parents are cooperating with the love of the Creator. So also in the conference for the engaged, I give a metaphor of these twofold ends of marriage, of unity and procreation, of babies and bonding, and talk about just the idea of wanting to make coffee in a coffee pot or something. And, we have to know what the coffee pot is for. It's like, okay, it's for the creation of coffee. And then what goes into that process? Well, I mean, namely, we have to like plug it in. This is where the analogy gets very direct, right? So, but we need electricity to be flowing in the wall, going like from the female socket to the male part of the coffee pot. So that is the unity that's going on, but that unity really only makes sense if there's life there, if there's electricity. Right? So it doesn't make sense for there to be that union if there's no life, nor is it really possible or advisable to get that electricity, to get that life there, without having that exclusive unity, for it just to be crashing all over the walls. Right? So by its very design, the sexual act is designed for this unity, which is ordered towards the creation of life, and by extension of that, that unity needs to have a permanence to raise that life. It's also kind of curious, sometimes I reflect on like all the mammals on the planet, what other mammal has like essentially a nurturing process of like 18 to 30 years? And like that's also by design too, of we're not just like whatever, deer or something, okay, so they're going to be conceived in November, born in the spring, and then by the winter, they're on their own. So, there's just a couple short months where they're following mama around, and then they're completely independent. Right? So that we're unique in that sense, too, where, humans will die if they're left alone, very early on. And then, depending on kind of what the upbringing it is, sometimes that attachment, that umbilical cord will stay there into their 20s, or even beyond if you're Italian or something, right? That reality, just how we're made as mammals, speaks to the fact that marriage is supposed to be permanent, to raise the children. Okay, so getting into, here's a slide I was supposed to turn a while ago. So chastity's the end goal for every person, married, single, consecrated, versus lust, right? Lust of the flesh, eyes, pride of life, is opposed to chastity because it allows the senses to dominate reason. Good little summary. Offenses against chastity. So this begins in Catechism 2351. It defines lust as a disordered desire or an inordinate enjoyment of sexual pleasure. Sexual pleasure is morally disordered when sought for itself, isolated from its procreative and unitive purposes. So those are also words that might need a little purifying. We might bring a little baggage, right? And to say a disordered act or a disordered desire. So we're certainly not calling people disordered, but we're saying that it's like order, like sin, hopefully you've heard before, is an old archery term in Greek, meaning to miss the mark. So the bullseye is like where that moral act is leading us. Right, so the moral act of the conjugal act is leading towards unity and procreation. So a sin would be something that misses the mark of either unity or procreation. Right, so that means okay, you're not exactly zeroed in. You're a little bit off, meaning you're disordered. It's the order is a little bit out of where your true zero should be. So that's what we're referring to when we're talking about a disordered act or a disordered desire, that your appetite is pushing you slightly off of where that desire should be pointing you towards. So here are some offenses. Masturbation. It is intrinsically and gravely disordered. It's sex outside of marriage with no chance of life. St. Thomas Aquinas even referred to this as worse than sodomy, because it does not involve another person, that it is completely self-enclosed. And certainly the sexual act that is removed from, there's absolutely zero chance of co-creating life, and there's zero chance of any unity at all. Fornication is contrary to the dignity of persons because sex is ordered towards the good of the spouses and the generation, education, children. So fornication meaning sex outside of marriage. Right, where both parties would be not married. So adultery would be either one or both of the couples are married and they have sex with somebody else. Pornography talks about how it perverts the sexual act and makes it an object of base pleasure. Unrelated to pornography, but somebody was talking about how they're giving up social media for Lent, and one of the difficulties was they don't know what their friends are up to. And it just kind of struck me. I've been off of it for a while, not because I'm like morally virtuous, but I just found it to be a complete waste of time. But the thought just came into me. Well, they don't know that you're not following them, but they don't know that you are following them. And so like the equivalent is like if you were just to go like up to their house and peek in the window, it's like, what are they up to? That's weird, but somehow we give ourselves a pass if like we're behind a screen and kind of removed from them. But it's just this like voyeuristic mentality. So pornography, likewise, like okay, it's very diffusive. Like a lot of people are either attached to it or addicted to it or watch it occasionally. But also that just like we would never, hopefully, go to somebody else's house and like peek in their window as they're having sex. That's essentially like what pornography is. And so it's certainly perverse in the sense that it takes something good and beautiful and makes it an object of entertainment. It certainly turns the people who are involved into actors and distorts the beauty of the sexual act. And certainly, obviously, prostitution reduces the person to an instrument of sexual pleasure. And rape, obviously, deeply wounds the respect, freedom, and integrity of the human person. Homosexual acts are intrinsically disordered. Again, not the people, but the act, saying that the act is ordered towards life, and there's no possibility of life. It is contrary to natural law because it closes the sexual act to the gift of life and does not proceed from a complementarity. So in the coffee analogy, like trying to get two coffee pots to generate electricity, it's not going to happen. It's kind of against the design of how it's made. Offenses against marriage. The catechism goes on, if we're not getting warmed up yet. 2370. Here it's quoting a document called Humana Vitae. And I'll do a small little tangent here on Humana Vitae, if you haven't heard of it. It was written by, St. Paul VI. It was Pope Paul VI at the end of the Second Vatican Council. So John the 23rd, St. John the 23rd, kicked off the Vatican Council, died, and then they had a conclave, and Paul VI continued it. And one of the questions that they did not tackle at the Second Vatican Council was contraception, which 30 years prior had just been approved by the Anglican Church, and many other Christian churches soon also approved it. So the question was, what are the Catholics going to do? So they didn't touch that beehive at the Second Vatican Council, and so they left it kind of to the Pope. The Pope sent out a survey to a lot of the bishops all over the world. And the majority report gave a caveat of why contraception might be morally permissible. And as the story goes, there was a Cardinal Archbishop of Krakow who would later become St. John Paul II, later become Pope, who wrote on his own authority, like nobody asked him to be part of the minority report, but he wrote one underlying all the reasons why this is simply unthinkable for a Catholic in Catholic tradition. And so Humana Vitae, as the story goes, is essentially a distillation of that minority report of John Paul II that Paul VI promulgated July 25th, 1968. Part of the reason why this was such a bombshell is that there were rumors, you know, things were being leaked about the majority report, and there was a full expectation the Catholic Church was going to change its teachings on this topic. So there's a lot of newspapers, fake news, we might say, saying, oh, you know, this is going to happen. And so even in seminaries, you know, they were teaching, you know, oh, the church is changing its teachings and blah, blah, blah. And so that's why so many people were surprised when we didn't change our teaching and, in fact, said we can't. And so this is the Catechism 2370, quoting Humana Vitae, paragraph 14. Every action which, whether in anticipation of the conjugal act or in its accomplishment or in the development of its natural consequences, proposes, whether as an end or as a means to render procreation impossible, is intrinsically evil. Like, mic drop. So a lot of kind of qualifiers there, but it basically says any contraception at all that seeks to render the sexual act infertile is intrinsically evil. And by intrinsic, it means in the very thing itself. That there's never, it might be permissible under certain circumstances. It's in itself, in the very act of that contraceptive act, it is evil, meaning against the mark. It is a sin. And so it talks about those qualifiers of in anticipation, so that might be things like a condom, in accomplishment, like the birth control pill, or in development, like Plan B. So they may not have taken a contraceptive before, or put up a barrier before, or taken a pill in anticipation of it, but after, it's like, we had quote-unquote unprotected sex and all these euphemisms, because who are you protecting yourself from? Right? So all these euphemisms that we've just kind of adopted as a culture really also bespeaks kind of the evil, safe sex. Well, what's dangerous about sex between a husband and a wife? Right? Unless they're like acrobats or something like that. That's weird. But protected sex so all these euphemisms really just bother me. And they should bother you too, because it doesn't reflect reality. The Plan B saying, okay, well, we didn't have a barrier, take a pill, but maybe we don't want to have a child now, so we'll take a pill that will essentially flush the uterine lining, and so any child that would have been conceived is going to be flushed out. So there's anti-unity. So sins against the unity of marriage, Catechism 2376. Techniques that entail the disassociation of husband and wife by the intrusion of a person other than the couple and those involving the married couple that disassociate the sexual act from the procreative act are morally unacceptable. right? And so they're essentially saying, okay, we're Catholic, like we're pro-life, like we want to have babies, but for whatever reason we haven't been blessed with babies yet. So you know, whether we figure maybe it's the power problem is with the guy's sperm, so can we donate some sperm or find some, or maybe it's with the ova, maybe we can get somebody else's egg and insert that, or a surrogate uterus, or IVF, maybe it's our own genetic material that we combine in a petri dish and then reinsert. And the church is saying no, because that human being deserves to be created out of this unity. And so anything that disassociates that unity, that act of, you know, the coffee machine, that unity and the life being one singular act, is no bueno. Genetic manipulation, the Catechism talks about, 2378. It talks about how a child is not something that is owed to anyone, but it is a gift. The supreme gift of marriage is a human person. A child may not be considered a piece of property. They have a right to be created within the context of conjugal love and all other rights guaranteed from their moment of creation. So here might be an important caveat of genetic manipulation, like, well, we want a girl, or we want someone with like blue eyes, or we want them to be a basketball player. Okay, that's genetic manipulation. What would be different would be a sort of like a genetic therapy, in the sense that any medicine, classically speaking anyway, is ordered towards the restoration of what is healthy. And so if there is some sort of defect, you can try to go and restore whatever that defect might be. Or if there's some sickness or illness, you can go in and try to help the child to restore their health. But what you're not doing is trying to create a designer baby. It also mentioned, so there's in marriage preparation, this is something that sometimes is surprising. Impotence is a impediment to marriage, but sterility is not. So this is in one sense how the church views the high gift of sexuality within marriage, that in order for it to be a valid marriage, that they need to be able to perform a sexual act within marriage. But if somebody knows, you know, they had an accident or something before, and for whatever reason, you know, they had a surgery, and so they're not fruitful, it's that it would be impossible through no fault of their own to conceive a child, the marriage can still proceed. That it's not as pro-life as we are as Catholics. Sterility is not an evil. Sometimes, sadly, it happens. But impotence, we say, is essential to constitute a marriage. Adultery, marital infidelity, even by desire, which was condemned by Christ, as we saw at the beginning. Divorce, the Church says in Canon Law 1141, that a ratified and consummated marriage cannot be dissolved by any human power for any reason other than death, right? Including the Pope, right? So a valid marriage, and that's what the whole annulment process is, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, in another RCIA, at least briefly, that the Pope is investigating, okay, is this a valid marriage or an invalid marriage? Because if it's valid, like, not even the Pope can dissolve that. That no human authority can dissolve what God has joined together. A separation, however, might be legitimate, right? Certainly, you know, if somebody has latent violence, so you didn't, you married somebody, you didn't know, you know, that they were latently an alcoholic, or maybe they were hiding it from you, and they're very a violent drunk, right? So certainly, it would say you would have a duty to remove yourself and any children from that situation. Or sadly, you know, sometimes there's like adult onset schizophrenia or something that you didn't know when you married them, but then, you know, they turn into a totally different person at times, or bipolar or something like this. So separation until you kind of figure that out and what's the best thing for that situation. Or, you know, would that potentially have invalidated the marriage? You know, certainly if they lied to you about it, or if you didn't know that this was part of them before you married them. Remarried spouses then, so if it's a valid marriage, there's a civil divorce, and then one of those people get civilly remarried, they're ultimately living in a state of public adultery because they're validly married, now living with somebody else and presenting themselves as married, which is adultery. It introduces a disorder into the family and society. It brings harm to the deserted spouses and traumatizes children. It is a plague on society. Certainly as a child of divorced parents, who I love both of them, I appreciate the catechism's bluntness there. Polygamy certainly is a sin against marriage. Incest, obviously, trial marriages, cohabitation, playing house, all that is chipping away at the dignity and the original intention of what God desires for marriage. And then to end on a positive note, the Catechism in 2517 following talks about how chastity is a gift. So it's something that to be requested, right? It's something that to be appreciated, like a Christmas gift or something. But it's also a virtue. It means that it needs to be practiced. It needs to be worked on. That it's not something that is typically infused in us and that we're perfectly chaste. It's typically something that we receive as a gift, but then we have to exercise. So it might be a set of weights that we were given, but then we have to use them if we want to get it strong. Purity of vision. So this is something where we can see something that might be an occasion of sin, but then what's our next response? So we acknowledge it, but then what do we do after we acknowledge it? Right? Do we take that to prayer? Do we know ourselves well enough to say I have to avert my eyes, or do I say a prayer for that person? Kind of weep that they don't recognize their own beauty. That prayer certainly helps to elevate our desires beyond our sensitive appetites, right? We see that plate of bacon on Good Friday. That needs to turn into a prayer like, Lord, get this temptation away from me. Like, help me to be strong. Like who put this here? And smite them. modesty protects the intimate center of the person, refusing to unveil what should remain hidden, both physically and emotionally. There's a emotional immodesty, meaning revealing too much too soon or to the wrong person, right? So modesty can also be one of those bugaboo words where we need to purify, like chastity or something, where it's like not a bad word. In fact, it's a great word in the sense that we're focusing on the totality of the person. So someone who dresses immodestly is saying, hey, look at this particular part, but don't look at me, right? Immodest talk or immodest emotional relationships kind of be somebody who's particularly needy or shares way too much about themselves up front. And it's like, whoa, like that. I'm not in a position to handle that or to deal with that. Right? But the person kind of receiving that, doesn't necessarily know how to respond. So same thing if, you see somebody walking down the street half naked, say, like, whoa, like that's not meant for me. Like, what are you doing? So they're physical, certainly, but also emotional immodesty. Revealing kind of too much of a part to the wrong person too soon. And certainly, within marriage, it's called, you don't cease to be modest, but you recognize this is the person I can share everything with. That it's not immodest to have that sort of intimacy within marriage, certainly within prayer, right? But we have to kind of know, be cognizant of the other people around us. A culture of modesty, kind of that story I gave of the advertisements, but also how we talk, the company we keep. That human freedom ultimately is about creating an environment where we can more freely, where it's easier to choose the good, and not about doing simply what our animal appetites are pushing us to do. So it's creating an environment where choosing the good is easier, and we try to make it easier for one another. All right, so lastly, I'll just talk real quick about ancient Rome, just in regards to marriage and sexual morality, because there's a lot of parallels, and I'm certainly not the first person to point this out. But we're probably worse when it comes to the morality, sexual morality that was present in ancient Rome. Fun fact, the word fornication comes from a street in Rome, the Via Fornaci, because that's where all the prostitutes would hang out. So that's where one would go to fornicate, in Via Fornaci. So I taught you a little something about linguistics tonight. But what was unique and what was different about Rome is they still highly prized the institution of marriage. So even though like sodomy was rampant and even, sex with children was a thing, like ritualized prostitution was a thing, they all considered that to be certainly not marriage, but not dignified. Like they kind of like tolerated it as a culture. But they safeguarded marriage as like a man and a woman for the procreation of a family to bring stability to society. So even within pagan Rome, so you had to have kind of the permission of whoever kind of the leading man of your tribe was, both for the bride and also the groom. So the groom would have to go to his dad or his uncle or his grandfather, whoever was kind of like the patriarch, and say, could you please vouch for me that I'm competent, I'm willing, and I'm able to marry Susie Q. And so it would be the dads of both would go to the judge and say, I'm here to speak on behalf of my daughter, on behalf of my son. So it was a very kind of official but noble practice within ancient Rome. Certainly ancient Christians and ancient Jewish people, the pater familiae, the dad of the family wasn't necessary. Still the idea was it was the consent of the bride and the groom. That's kind of what made marriage exist. In the barbarian Norse, so you know, Viking kind of Germanic cultures, marriage was contracted by consummation, and it wasn't always consensual. So I mean, essentially we would just call it rape. But for them, in a really sick and twisted way, this was a civilizing factor, because whatever, if a guy like stole a bride, he would then have to take care of her. It was then her responsibility and all the children that came forth. So he had to kind of like choose wisely in that sense. So for them, that was saying, okay, this is what's going to kind of rein in these animal impulses is, you know, you took her to the dance and now you have to bring her home. Like that is how kind of the barbarian culture operated. In the Far East, so we certainly know that consent was paramount, but it wasn't the consent of the bride and the groom. It was the consent of the family, so arranged marriages. So those are kind of three main ways that different civilizations have constituted marriage. Now, the Catholic Church has always kind of been in a tug of war between not just, you know, the barbarians and arranged marriages, but tug of war between like this Puritanism and this licentiousness. And certainly our culture, we arguably, is very much on the licentious side of the pendulum. But within church history, you've had different religious sects that would present themselves to be very pious and everything else that would say it's wrong to get married. It's wrong to have any sexual desires, like Albigensians or Manichaeans that would deny the goodness of the created world. And surprisingly, they had a pretty big following. And so we might think of like some of the Puritans, you know, part of our ancestors in America that would have some of these leanings of denying the goodness of marriage, of sex, of the created world. But then the opposite side of the spectrum that we're living in today is just give in to free reign. If it feels good, do it. And the church is always trying to find that sweet spot, that middle area of between decadence, moral laxity, and Puritanism, of trying to find like, okay, it's good, but it has to be ordered. Right? To really try to get us to ask the question, what is it for? Here's a coffee pot. Here's a wall outlet. Like, what now? You know, so a man, a woman, like, what? How? You know, if you're just standing in the mirror, like, how do I make sense? What are these organs for, right? And trying to understand how is it ordered and where is that order moving me? And how do I get my thoughts, my feelings, my desires and everything on that train, on that rightly ordered train, which leads ultimately to human flourishing and freedom, not repression. Okay, so why should this matter? Ultimately, in this very last point, then we'll land the plane, take a break, and have small group discussions. This is all about freedom. Right, because Christ came to make us free, that sin ultimately will lead to slavery. And not just like in super extreme examples of, you know, somebody who enjoys alcohol and they enjoy it a little too much for the wrong reasons, then eventually they're addicted, right? That's a very clear example of how something good as alcohol can clearly lead to a form of freedom where the alcoholic is not free, right? You take that example into really anything that is good, and that we can have this disordered attraction, this disordered desire for it, and then eventually that can lead us into a form of freedom. There are plenty of people who are addicted, whether it's their phone or pornography or prostitution, all these things that, you know, they started out and they were a quasi-normal teenager with normal desires and just kept giving in to those desires in a disordered way, so they're not free anymore. Right? So it's not that those desires are bad, it's not that our sexuality is bad, quite the contrary, but we really have to see them in an ordered way so that we can experience freedom in all of our desires. So if I can't put that plate of bacon down, I'm really not free to eat it in a certain sense. Right? It's a freedom so that we can actually see the other person and not just their parts. Or we can see the totality of the person, their hopes, their dreams, their aspirations, their backgrounds, their flaws. We can see the totality of the person, not just what can they do for me. It's a freedom so that we can actually love the other person, which means that we desire their good. We desire their good for their own sake, not for our sake. Well, if I love them right, then my life will be easier. So, no, I love them right for their own sake. Not for any payoff or any reward or an easier life in return. Not to be dominated by our selfishness, our lust, or for any self-gain. Okay, so 5-minute break. Great. And then we'll get instructions for small group discussion.